There's a great story, and a lot of the comics take credit for it, but it happened to Rich Jenny, where he was, I can't remember where he was in the South, and you know, he's a real New York guy, and he wasn't sure of a piece of material he was going to do, and so he said to the audience, he said, do you guys know what a bagel is? And the guy in the front row said, yeah, it's a hunting dog.
Well, hello there, and welcome to this week's edition of the Free Press Radio Show. My name is Brian Hanks. I'm your host for this little weekly joyride that we call the Free Press Radio Show, and the editor of your Kinston Daily Free Press, located in the beautiful tropical location of Kinston, North Carolina. His name, John Dawson. You keep getting us just outstanding guests. We've got a great one from he's a head writer for the David Letterman Show. Just real quick, little quick bio on him here. After 12 years touring as a stand-up comedian, Bill Sheff was hired as monologue writer for Late Night with David Letterman in 1991. During his 23 years with Letterman, Sheff has been nominated for 16 Emmy Awards. He wrote for the 1995 and 2005 Academy Awards, was the head writer for 3 ESPY Awards, and has contributed special material to the Emmys, Tonys, and Grammys. Bill Sheff is also the author of the critically acclaimed novels The Ringer, which came out in 2002, Time Won't Let Me, which came out in 2005, and Everything Hurts, which came out in 2009. His latest work, Shrink Thyself, from Rare Bird Books. In addition to his long-form fiction, Bill Sheff is widely known for his weekly humor column, The Show, which appeared in Sports Illustrated for 3 years. A collection of his columns, The Best of the Show, was published in 2005 before coming to Sports Illustrated. Sheff spent 2.5 years at ESPN The Magazine writing a similar column called The Monologue. His love of sports writing came from his uncle, the legendary golf writer Herbert Warren Wind. In 2011, he edited and wrote the foreword to a collection of Wind's seminal essays, America's Gift to Golf, Herbert Warren Wind on the Masters. We're very excited to have him here on the show.
And after all everything he's accomplished in his career, he somehow ended up
on the Free Press Radio Show. And now joining us here on the Free Press Radio Show, as promised, is Bill Sheff. Mr. Sheff, I tell you what, I hope in our, you know, we were just talking before we came on the air here. I'm hoping my producer boy over here, John Dawson, does a really good job of saving that, because we could have done a whole show with that. It was so awesome, sir.
Yeah, well, that's, I appreciate you saying that, and you know, it's we'll leave that for others. But that, you know, you do the stuff in the diner. And then you do the stuff on stage, right? And there's a great line in Mr. Saturday Night, which wasn't a great movie by Billy Crystal, but there were a couple of beautiful lines in it, and Billy Crystal accuses his brother of just having living room balls, and where he can only perform in the living room. And so you get a little living room material, and then you get a little stage material.
The main character of your new book, Shrink Thyself, what was the catalyst, or what drove you to create the character Charlie Traub?
Okay. In my first 3 novels, I had at least one unorthodox therapist in every one of the novels. And so I finish Everything Hurts, and I don't know what my next book's going to be about, but I say to myself, you know, that's it. It's enough with the shrinks. You can't have any more unorthodox shrinks. You've done this in every book. And, you know, sure, it's interesting, and sure, it interests you, but you really, you got to broaden it out a little. So this book is going to be non-psychological. This book is, you know what, this book is going to be about a guy who's living the non-psychological life, who's living the unexamined life. So I was quite taken with that. And a guy, and then I decided, well, maybe it's a guy that is out of therapy, and he's become friends with his ex-therapist. And, you know, again, that's kind of intriguing. And then I got about 10 pages in, and I said, you know, let's just do this one more time. But let's have the therapist be really nuts this time. Let's just do it once more, and let's make this guy really, really nuts. At some point, let's have his former patient go in for sessions and visit the guy while he's in a locked ward at a mental hospital. And let's have the guy be really inappropriate. And then, and let's have things happen to this guy out of therapy that would send any other person screaming back into therapy. Let's have this guy's mother die in a way that would send Freud back to dental school. And that was the catalyst, is that I wanted to stop doing what I'd been doing. And what I ended up doing was what I'd done in the past, but on a much more ambitious, much more, much more self-obsessed level of main character. It's the first book I've written in the first person, so which was a little inside joke with myself where, you know, a guy leaves therapy to lead the unexamined life, and yet in the novel that's written, it's in the first person, so half the words are I in the novel. So he's still self-obsessed.
Once you got the idea to write the book, do you create an outline and try to fill it in, or do you just do the Kerouac thing and just start writing and see what happens?
Well, first of all, never compare me to Kerouac. Really, you get your podcast license suspended comparing me, because, you know, it's unfair that he's called an author and I'm called an author. And it reminds me of a great joke that a comic, Ron Zimmerman, used to do about how Robert De Niro shot and killed Anson Williams at a Hollywood party when Anson Williams said to him, "Oh, you're an actor just like me." I don't have an outline. I hope I can put this so it makes sense. I need two pieces to start a book. I need either like a character in a situation, or two characters, a character and an action. So I had a character, you know, I had the main character and his former therapist, and that was enough to start. And if I'm lucky, and so I don't do an outline. I take notes occasionally. Oh, don't forget this, and you want to get to here. But there's never an outline. And in every book that I've done, and I'm right there with this book that I'm working on right now, which is a sequel to my first novel, The Ringer, invariably, you know, I try to write half the book just so I can tell myself, oh, you know what, I think this is a book. And I have no idea. I never have any idea what the second half is going to be. And then I have to do, you know, the thinking that I don't like to do. So, you know, on a good day, at the end of a writing session, I have an idea what the next writing session will cover. But that doesn't happen a lot.
How much of what you write is, I wouldn't call it autobiographical, but that you inject part of, you know, I mean, you live a very interesting life. How much of that do you add in to your books? And how long is your average writing session?
Okay. I would say in the past, in my other novels, I think it goes about 60-40.
Okay.
I think about 60% is based on real. It's real people and real events from my life made more complicated. Because that's the best advice I ever got about fiction: make your characters' lives more complicated. Because everybody thinks their lives are interesting, and they probably are, but they're not complicated. And that's the great thing about fiction, and that's what makes fiction interesting. Complicated, but plausible. It's got to be plausible. So this book, I would say, is the least... Boy, every time I say this, I want to correct myself, but I'll say it's the least amount of autobiographical stuff. I mean, I've created more out of whole cloth here than in the past. But yet, you know, the character of Cy Siegel was based on my old next-door neighbor, Marvin Siegel, who just died a month ago. And my wife and I were very upset because we were so fond of him. And I said, geez, you know, he died before I could make him famous. And I went to his funeral, and I'd never met his family. And I told some stories about, you know, their relative. And I said, oh, yeah, by the way, he's in my book that's coming out next month. There's always... all I have is my experience. I think the less of that, the more ambitious the project is, and everything is worthwhile. And in terms of a session, you would be surprised if I told you if I can go for 2 hours, I'm happy. That's a good session. I rarely go for more than that because, for me, it's such a state of mind, and it's a little bit, it makes you kind of loopy, and I can only go for so long. There's a lot of novelists that, you know, it's a gig. It's 8-9 hours a day. Sit down, strap on. And for me, it's not like that, and I don't ever want it to be like that. I wouldn't mind getting to 3 hours because that was how long John Updike's sessions were. You know, to me, that would be a good thing to shoot for. But they're mostly they're about 2 hours long, and I get anywhere from 250 to, you know, close to 1,000 words. I've written over 1,000 words in a session about 5 or 6 times. And, you know, Hemingway, that was his dream, to write 1,000 words in a day. And what would happen was he'd get up, or he'd come to. he would write. He would have a really good morning and write about 400-500 words. And then he would have lunch, and we know what his lunch was. And then he would, you know, then it would be the next morning, the next thing you knew. And he had where he lived in Cuba, and I've seen this wall. He had a brick wall, and on each brick was a different number, and that number represented how many words in the session the day before. And it's all 300, 400, 500. He never got to 1,000 words in a day. And I don't know why that's a magic mark, but it is. But it's all numbers for me. I know when I start a book, I got to get to 80,000 words. And I know that 80,000 words is probably about between 250 and 300 sessions. And, you know, I don't write every day. I can't because of my job at the show. And, you know, that's what it is. It gets to be, there's a lot of math to it. And there's great comfort in, well, that's why I love uniform numbers. There's great comfort in numbers to me. And it makes it easy to create when you put the numbers off to one side.
Your wife is a gifted comic as well.
She sure is.
And I would assume that, and she may disagree with me, but I would assume that when you get home or before you leave every day, if you just left a tape recorder running, you could probably have a book or a comedy album a month come out of conversations between you two. Any interactions between you and your wife end up in any of the books, even in a massed form?
I think a few. I think, you know, she's a great reader. She, you know, I have about four people that I trust who read the stuff as I'm writing it. She's one of them. It's not as much stuff as recreated in the books between us as you think, but I will say that all the great, I like writing, I can only write, I only had a couple of moves, I can only really write one female character, and that's the woman that's too smart for her own good, you know, that, and that's that prison that some women have to live in, where they're just too bright for the rest of the world, and I love writing those characters, and they're always versions of my wife. You know, as I say, you know, every female character I write has some version of my wife's mouth and my wife's, you know, brain. And yeah, do we have a lot of laughs? Yeah, but mostly it's funny because mostly it's the shorthand between two people that have lived together, that've been together for so long, and trust each other. And yeah, we get going and we have big laughs. But most of the thing we there's a great line in Mean Streets, which is one of her favorite movies, where it's De Niro and Harvey Keitel, and they're in the back of the bar, and De Niro is telling some story. He talks about running into Joey Clamps, and Keitel says, "You mean Joey Sparks? Joey Clamps? No, Joey Sparks, same guy." And they're talking about the same guy. He has two nicknames, and so whenever Adrian and I are having some conversation and we're both saying the same thing in different ways, it's a race to see who the first one is says, "No, Joey Clamps," to each other, so that we have that shorthand between each other. And you know, it's great living with someone who gets me, because that's a small club. That is an incredibly small club. That might be a club with one member, you know, her.
Her line about doing stand-up in Los Angeles is the
funniest. Oh, my God. Well, she hates Los Angeles. She hates the audiences in Los Angeles because it's tough trying to make people laugh when their stitches are healing.
Thank you very much. I've been waiting for that all week.
Oh, you love that line.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has, yeah. Well, there's many, many, many beauties in her act. And she's on YouTube and... yeah, she's just people say to me, "Hey, I hear your wife is funny." I always say, "No, she's funnier." You know, that's and that's how I feel about her.
A lot of people go into therapy because they have mother issues, and I've always thought the way your mother loved you was interesting. Do you want to share that with people who may not have heard that scenario?
My mother, well, I'll tell you well, the line that you want is when I said to her one time, "Mom, what about unconditional love?" And she said to me, "I'll show you unconditional love when you've earned it." And here's a great story. So when my first book comes out, The Ringer, and it's, you know, all my books are set equally in Boston and New York, and because that's where I've spent, you know, 90% of my time. And so I get a big reading at this big Borders bookstore for my first book, just outside of Boston. And that morning, I go on a radio show with a great, legendary local comic from Boston, Steve Sweeney, has me on to his show to promote my book. So I tell my mother the night before, "I'm going to be on Sweeney's radio show. Will you want to hear it?" She says, "Yeah." So I set her radio to the correct coordinates. And then I say to her, "Listen, would you like to introduce me at the reading tomorrow night?" And she says, "Oh, I'd love to." And so I see her later that day before the gig, before the reading, and I say to her, "Did you hear me on Sweeney's show?" And she said, "Well, I listened to the first couple of minutes, but then you started talking about people I've never heard of, so I shut it off."
Wow.
As I like to say about my mother, she was a stay-at-home narcissist.
So, but she was still Mother Teresa compared to Johnny Carson's mom, obviously.
Well, you know, she was, yeah, well, I look, the thing about her is, and she's still alive, is that she loves me. She was she's always been thoroughly entertained by me, and that was my job, to entertain her. And she's always going to be the smartest person in the room. She's incredibly bright. She loves Adrian. You know, her best quality is that she loves my wife. And but she is, you know, like I said, she was a stay-at-home narcissist. And So here's her introduction of me that night at my first big reading in Boston, my first novel. I'm going to do the entire text of her introduction of me that night. She gets behind the microphone and she says, "And then when he was six, he used to dance around the living room singing, 'I enjoy being a girl.'" You know, and people wonder why I've been in therapy for four decades. You know, that's the introduction.
Well, that path has led you to great things, though.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm going to ask two more questions related to the book, and then I'm going to turn it over to Brian the Greek over here. Therapists that have read your stuff, do they have a sense of humor about themselves, or do they try to have you committed because they don't like the way you make fun of them?
What I think is that I think that therapists read my book and, like a guy who weighs 400 pounds reading a book about a guy who weighs 900 pounds, they think, "Oh, he's not talking about me. There's a guy, you know, he's talking about someone who's really nuts." And the thing about therapy, I mean, I've had some good ones and I've had some interesting ones. You know, there's a million therapists and there's seven good ones. You know, it's like stockbrokers. There's a million stockbrokers, and there's seven guys that'll make you money. And, you know, I hope you get one of the seven. You know, there's a great, I don't know if you remember this comic, Bob Shaw, who was a great, great comic. He was the generation before me. He was good friends with Larry David. He was a wonderful writer, but he was a great comic. And I was working a gig in the Village. The show was me, him, and Larry David. And he went on first, I went on second, and Larry closed. So he is working the audience. And there's a guy in the audience. He says, "Anybody from out of town?" And a guy says, "Yeah." And he says, "Where are you from?" The guy says, "I'm from Oklahoma City." And he says, Bob Shaw says, "Really, what do you do in Oklahoma City?" He says, "I'm a psychotherapist." And he says, "Really? Well, what do you charge in Oklahoma City for a psychotherapy session?" He says, "I charge $100 for 35 minutes. And Bob Shaw says, "Really?" He says, "35 minutes?" He says, "Because, you know, all you ever hear about in psychotherapy is the 50-minute hour. It's the standard, the 50-minute hour." He said, "And you charge for 35 minutes. He said, "Is it because you're that good or because people in Oklahoma City have so little to talk about that the session only lasts 35 minutes. Bob Shaw says, "Doc, how many times do I have to tell you? Once when I was 14, I feel real bad about it, and I'll never do it again."
Oh,
wait a minute. Have you ever been to Kinston, North Carolina, sir?
Oh, boy. One last question here related to the book. In your job writing for Letterman, I think you've said you write anywhere from 30 to 50 jokes on a show day.
Correct.
And you've done that for roughly 23 years.
Yeah.
That muscle you've built up to do that, how does that inform when you're writing an extended narrative, or does it not play into it at all?
It doesn't play into it at all. That's a great question. And the thing is it's two completely different muscles. And it's the difference, you know, writing jokes for a living, that's the quick twitch muscle. That's like the track star. That's the sprinter. You know, that's the muscle that has to fire rapidly, where you're just free associating off of free association all the time. You know, you see Dick Cheney's name in the paper, and you know, he says, you know, that Obama has made all the mistakes in Iraq. And, you know, your mind goes, Dick Cheney, heart problems, warmonger, shot a buddy in the face. And then you start free associating. How can I tie this in for what he said? And that's how it works. It's just free association off of free association. And you boil it down. It's a little like making crack.
And almost as lucrative, right?
Well, absolutely. And with novel writing, this is just my experience, everything slows down, and you have to get yourself in a state of mind where you available to sort of inhabit this world that you've created and these characters that you've created. And when it just slows down to where you think, now what would this guy say? Not some wise guy response, but what would this guy really say in this situation? Or where would he go? Or the fact that writing a novel in the first person, which I thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I can just, you know, I did this and I, you know. And after like 10 pages, I realized, oh, wait a minute. I can't write about what any other character is thinking because I'm writing in the first person. So I just have to move and observe. So that's the thing. Am I moving enough?
That voice you're listening to, that's Bill Scheft. His newest book, Shrink Thyself, is out. You can go grab a copy of that. And I'm supposed to be asking you the sports questions, but you've inspired me so much listening to you about the way you write and construct. I've got to ask you, one of the things I love asking authors is, you know, who did you read when you were growing up? And put you on the spot, Bill. What is the last book that you read, maybe it's on your nightstand right now, but the last book that you've read, sir?
The last two books that I've read, I reread Adriana Trigiani's first book, which, oh my God, how come I can't, here's the 57-year-old man. How come I can't remember her, it's her first book. I got to go find it. But I reread that because we did a Q&A at the Strand, and I wanted to, Big Stone Gap. She's a wonderful writer. She writes about the South a lot, actually, because she grew up in Virginia. And so I read that. That's the last novel I read. And then last weekend, I read there's a biography of Bill Cosby coming out in the fall, written by a guy I went to school with, Mark Whitaker. And wow, I read that book in 3 days. It's 500 pages. And I'm not that kind of reader. I'm not a good reader. But I really devoured that book. And, you know, Bill Cosby, he's been around, and you think you know his story. But just speaking for myself, I forgot so much. I forgot, you know, the guy's been a pioneer 4 different times. So it was just a tremendous read. And so those are the last two books I read. The book on my nightstand right now. Well, let's go over to my nightstand. I know what it is. I'm reading. I'm sort of back and forth with George Sanders' short story collection, The 10th of December, which everybody loves, and you know he's a great writer. And also, I'm in the middle of this book, The Trip to Echo Spring, which is Olivia Lang wrote this. She's a British writer, and it's about great alcoholic writers, you know, like Cheever and Hemingway. And so you know, that's that's all you need to get me in the tent, alcoholism and writers.
There you go. Just to show you how small the world is, I didn't even know of the book you were just speaking of, A Big Stone Gap. Just, again, to show you how small this world is, my people are from Big Stone Gap and Fancy Gap and Galax and Hillsville, Virginia. All that's in the same neck of the woods in southwestern Virginia. Now, you've given me a book to read because I didn't even...
She is incredibly prolific.
Okay.
She's written, I want to say she's written 9 novels. She has 2 types of novels that she writes. She writes novels about down there, Big Stone Gap, and her second one was, I think, Big Cherry Holler, and then she also writes books, because she's Italian-American, she writes a lot of books about Italian-Americans in novels. The Shoemaker's Wife was one, but she is a wonderful, very vivid writer, and funny like a comic, and she worked in television for a while. Her husband, the reason I know her, is her husband is the sound guy, the sound technician on the Letterman show. And that's how I met her. She gave me a wonderful blurb for Everything Hurts, And then when we were trying to put together an event for this book, my wife came up with the suggestion of having her interview me, and my publisher loved it, and she was great. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of sweet tea.
Well, I can tell you this, next time you talk to her, say, hey, I came on this podcast in Little Kinston, North Carolina, and I sold you a book, because I will be picking that one up for sure, sir.
I'm going to tell you a guy you know, because I'm the fifth of six children. My oldest brother is named Tom. He went to UNC and never left. He graduated in 1971, and he stayed down there for the last 35 years. He's been a professor of English and education at North Carolina Central in Durham. Well, one of his best friends, and a guy he went through graduate school with, is one of the great Southern authors, one of the underrated Southern authors, Clyde Edgerton, who I know you know, who writes about Apex, North Carolina.
Absolutely.
And I'm telling you, nobody can write about food and complicated people like Clyde Edgerton. He's a wonderful writer.
I'm excited to pick your brain a little bit here on the sports world. Let's get away from writing a little bit. I want to see what you think about some of the big issues that are going on right now in sports.
Okay, let's try this. Yeah,
there you go. Well, the big thing to me is, you know, a lot of debate when I talk with all my buddies who are big sports fans too, are the whole steroid generation that just came through. You know, baseball really, I guess you can say it's been sort of cleaned up in the last 4 or 5 years or so. But how would you, I'm going to make you, Bill Schaeft, the commissioner of baseball for a day or for a week. Would you admit the players that if they were to come forward and say, you know what, you know, the Barry Bonds, who's alleged to have used steroids, and some of the other guys, would you allow them to be in the Hall of Fame if they stepped up and said that they did use steroids?
You know, I would, and this is why. And it's funny because I'm writing a sequel to my first novel, The Ringer, and it has a lot to do with the steroid era. And here's how I feel. I think that baseball can't have it both ways. I think that baseball can't, you know, wring its hands and say, you know, how terrible it all is, when baseball turned its back on this problem for years and years and years and basically winked at the players and said, hey, you know, if this gives you an edge, just don't be stupid about it. And this is why a guy like Andy Pettit, this is why he's not vilified, because he's the only guy I can think of that did it, came forward, apologized. And so, you know, I think that he is in better shape than the guys that were advised to just keep denying and, you know, see if you can catch them. Because, you know, science is always going to be ahead of law enforcement. That's just a fact. So, you know, 5 years from now, there's going to be something other than human growth hormone. There's going to be, you know, and it's always going to be like that. And players are always trying to get an edge. And, you know, I'm not condoning putting something in your body that's bad for you. But like Chris Rock says, if I could take a pill that would make me a better comic, I would take it.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
But I think that, everybody, having said that, I think that players have to be judged differently. I don't think that the metrics are the same. Like, I don't think that Rafael Palmeiro is a Hall of Famer, even though his numbers are Hall of Fame numbers. I don't think he is. You know, and so that would be an example. I mean, Sammy Sosa's a tough call. I would say no to Sammy Sosa and yes to Mark McGwire in terms of, are they Hall of Famers? I think Barry Bonds is definitely a Hall of Famer because he was, you know, he was a dominant player. Look, you know, the best example I can give are racket sports. because over the years, the equipment has changed in racket sports, tennis and squash. And what happens is that the people that get the new equipment first, have access to it first, they kind of jump ahead. But when everybody has access to the same advanced equipment, the best players are still the best players. So I think that if nobody had used steroids, Barry Bonds still would have been just about the best player in baseball. My complaint with Barry Bonds is I always think he was overrated as a fielder. You know, I thought he was overrated as a fielder. I never thought he was as good a fielder as people said he was.
Well, he would have been a perfect designated hitter in the American League, correct?
Yes, he would have. Yes, he would have. And so I don't resent players trying to stay in the game and make more money and have an edge. I don't resent that at all. What I do resent is the governing body acting as if, they're the villains. And, you know, we tried. But meanwhile, everybody made a lot of money off steroids.
Oh, absolutely.
Everybody. A lot of people made a lot of money off steroids. And, not just the guys dealing them. You know, Alex Rodriguez, you know, he's a bad guy because he keeps lying. You know, and it's not that, and I'm not being, I don't want to be moralistic and say, oh, you know, he's a liar. But the thing is that, look, you did it. You know you did it. You know, stop thinking that you're smarter than everybody else. You're not, you know. And it's too bad because easily as talented a player as has ever played the game, but if he had just come forward and, you know, rather than been handled, you know, he would, there'd be no question he would be in the Hall of Fame. But now he just keeps tarnishing his own legacy, and it's on him. And that's the hubris. That's my problem.
And that's the reason I felt like I framed that question to you that way. These guys that continuously deny it, I don't think they deserve it. But if, you know, like I said, you're commissioner for a week and you tell, you know, you put it out there for the players, hey, if you did steroids, you confess to it, you know, sign a confession, whatever, then you'll be eligible for the Hall of Fame. You know, then you would have the opportunity, you know, to be in the Hall of Fame. But I'm with you, sir. I mean, the people who continuously deny it, the A-Rods, the Barry Bonds, those type, I don't think there's a place in the Hall. But which leads me to my next question for you, sir. Pete Rose, I mean, one of the most, that's who, I'm 45 years old, and that's who I grew up, just loved watching him play. And, I mean, the man was all out all the time. He never wanted to lose. Should he be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, absolutely, he should be in the Hall of Fame. But here's the problem with Pete Rose. The problem was, and having been a compulsive gambler and having not made a bet, and we can talk about that later. The problem with Pete Rose is the same as A-Rod's problem, was his hubris, that he went in and he was offered. Well, you know, admit you did this, and, you know, you'll be suspended. You won't be on the permanent ban list. You'll be suspended for however long, and that'll be it. It'll be a finite thing. You know, you can take that, or you can take the lifetime ban. And he took the lifetime ban because he thought, like people do who, you know, are like that, who are delusional, he thought, well, the lifetime ban doesn't apply to me. I'm Pete Rose. So his problem is that he is suffering the consequences of his decision. And, I think Pete Rose will get in the Hall of Fame, you know, 2 days after he dies.
I would 100% agree with you. How much of this do you think is, to use an old Seinfeld reference, George Costanza, if you tell a lie and you believe it, then it's not really a lie. I mean, some of these guys, I get that sort of feeling, maybe the A-Rod part of it and Pete Rose, that they've told this lie so many times, they start to believe it a little bit. Is that Is that at all possible?
1,000%. And my a good friend of mine who was my editor at Sports Illustrated, Kostya Kennedy, wrote a tremendous book about Pete Rose that came out a few months ago. Really, a real insight into the guy. And that, it's actually more lucrative for Pete Rose for him not to be in the Hall of Fame right now. And he's made a great living off of it, as a real degenerate gambler would. He found a way, you know, to sort of dope fiend the world and make money off the fact that he wasn't in the Hall of Fame and that he's this victim. And this is the thing: if you keep acting like the victim, you believe you're the victim, and that's where these guys are. And you know, I have a lot of friends who I started out when I was a sports writer, and they're still sports writers, and they're great sports writers. Tim Layden, who writes for Sports Illustrated, who's as good as anybody.
Yeah.
Tim Layden covered Mike Tyson very early because he was in Albany and Tyson was from that area. And then Tyson broke through and then, you know, it was on top of the world. And then he started to have his problems. And I saw him one time. I said, what is the problem with Mike Tyson? And he says, Mike Tyson's problem is that he believes the last person he spoke to. And I'd never heard that said about people. Now I know a lot of people like that. And I just think that A-Rod is one of those guys. That's why he's so many lawyers. He's just going to keep shopping until the guy who says what he wants to hear says that to him. And, you know, it's really a shame. But, none of these guys have hit bottom yet. I don't care what Pete Rose says or Lance Armstrong. They really haven't hit bottom yet. Because if you keep thinking you're the victim, then you haven't hit bottom. Because that's what fuels you.
Yeah, oh yeah, the motivation that the whole world is against me.
Of course. And I mean, there's believe me, as a guy that spent years like that, there's energy there. But there's a great line: there is no truth in victimization. And that's where these guys are. And there's a little part of me that feels sorry for them. But this is, haven't you had enough?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you want to say that to all of them. Haven't you had enough?
Well, as you know, down in our neck of the woods, and speaking for myself too, I'm a huge Washington Redskins fan. And you know, I know you're on top of everything that's been going on there with the United States Patent Office. Taking away the, I guess people can start using the Redskins name as after it gets appealed and all that. But what is your take? I'm real curious. You being up in New York, like you said, being a New York Boston guy. Well, what is your take on this whole Redskins controversy? And if you had to, okay, now I'm putting the hat on as NFL commissioner. What would you change the Redskins name to if they're ultimately forced to change the name?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed by this because I've kind of come around to this late because in the sense that I've come around to how much this needs to be changed very late in the game because, you know, it's like, geez, I grew up on this and I had no idea it was offensive. You know, why are they just bringing it up now? And now I realize this has been going on a long time, and, you know, now I'm just being made aware of it. Keith Olbermann has the best idea. Keep the logo and change the name of the Washington Americans. That's it. Keep the logo. You know, and as he said, Dan Snyder, they'll have parades for Dan Snyder. But here's the thing about Roger Goodell. And, you know, Roger Goodell spent his whole life preparing to be commissioner of the NFL because he knew that once you get to there aren't many jobs like it in the sense that, you know, you're commissioner of the NFL and really everybody can just kiss your ass. Only answer to no one. But the problem is that unlike his predecessors, the job that he thought he was going to inherit is not the job he inherited. So he has two giant issues. He's got the Redskins issue, and he's got the concussion, traumatic injury, retired players issue. And those were issues that his predecessors really never had to deal with. And so he is annoyed that he really has to be a leader. And he's also annoyed that it's going to cost, you know, his league, which prints its own money, a lot of money. And you know, that's sort of just a roundabout way. I mean, they really have to. I love the NFL like your typical American sports fan. But, you know, we are weeks away from some guy getting killed in the middle of the game with the way the equipment is and with the way the players tackle.
Wow.
They're stronger, they're faster, and the equipment is just harder. You know, and players launch themselves, and we are weeks away from a guy just dying on the field after either being hit or hitting another guy.
I know, and it's just amazing that, you know, when you and I were both younger, the NFL put out the videos of the hardest hits and, you
right.
know, the hardest tackles, and now talk about backtracking from that and just realizing the things all those players went through.
Right, but they were irresponsible about the health of the retired players.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, two things. First of all, players tackled with their shoulder and their legs. They did not launch themselves head first at other players. And they were, you know, they were 20% smaller, and they were, they were 10% slower, you know? So this is just, you know, bigger, stronger, faster, and, you know, the way they tackle now, it's just a matter of time. So it was a different era back then. Yes, they have been very negligent about taking care of players, and, you know, that's lack of education. And I think that's easier to rectify than going forward. And it really has to start earlier. You know, there's a great thing they used to say about junior hockey in Canada. If you want to see the NHL in 5 years, go to a junior hockey game. And they just have to start teaching kids how to tackle correctly, you know. And the NFL, I mean, if they have to slow the game down and just throw a flag every other play because a guy tackles incorrectly, doesn't tackle with his shoulder, tackles head first, well, then so be it. So be it. But it's not an easy situation. The answers are not easy.
Absolutely. I could pick your brain for three more hours, and I know we don't have that kind of time. I'm going to ask you a couple more sports questions.
Well, let me just tell you this. I don't have three more hours of unpicked brain left. I got about 6 minutes of unpicked brain left because you've done a very good job.
Well, very good. Well, let me ask you about this. I had an opportunity to cover the U.S. Open last week down in Pinehurst, which is only about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes from Kinston. And I don't know how much of an opportunity you got to watch it, but, you know, Martin Keimer, the German, just blitzed through the whole field. I mean, he just,
right.
You know, minus nine. There's only three guys under par. He was eight strokes better than second place. But one of the things sitting in the media tent every day and getting to hear what other people were saying about it and walking the course every day, I got to hear Donald Trump's assessment of the course and how bad it looked and all this. I was wondering what your impression was on that. And I didn't know if you actually came down to Pinehurst yourself or if you watched it on TV. What was your impression of the way the course played, the way it looked on TV? Do you think it was the way it looked on TV was why the ratings were so slow or were so low? Or was it because of the way Keimer, a name that, you know, your average sports fan doesn't exactly know, but who is a very good golfer, controlled the whole field?
All right, I'm in the unique position to answer this because my uncle was Herbert Warren Wynn, the dean of American Golf Writers, the man who coined the term Amen Corner, a longtime writer for The New Yorker, so the greatest golf writer this country has ever produced, and I come from a golfing family. So I watch golf with great interest. Let me just say, as diplomatically as I can, that course has looked better. It might be a weather thing. It might be a tricked up thing. But it was tough to watch. It was tough to watch aesthetically. And my mother, who was a wonderful golfer, my mother shot her age at 77.
Wow. Mm.
My mother made that. And when my mother shot her age at 77, I said to my Uncle Herb, "Did you hear your sister shot her age at 77? And he said, "It's great to play alone, isn't it?"
My theory was they're saying it's going back to the original look to save money on water.
Well, okay, that's fine. I mean, I think that, look, boy, Donald Trump, really? Do we have to look, I think that he's done some fine work as a golf course architect. Not nearly as fine as he thinks he's done. And, and I think that he's spent a lot of money, but, you know, of course, every course that he designs is the most, he's been told is the most beautiful course in the world. So let's just put that aside. I feel like, you know, there's a great line in Pumping Iron when Arnold Schwarzenegger is really kind of needling Lou Ferrigno, and he says to him, "Oh, Louis, if this competition was in a month, you would win," meaning that Ferrigno just wasn't quite there. And that's how I felt looking at the course. Oh, I think they thought the tournament was next month. And as far as Martin Keimer and the ratings, I think there's something to that. I think that golf is desperate for a star, and I don't think they have one. That's the thing about golf, is the more impressive the victory, the more boring the tournament, because, you know, guys run away with it. So, I think that was a factor. It would have been great for television if somebody that people know, like Phil or even, you know, Rory McIlroy, or they like Bubba Watson, or, you know, those guys. Martin Keimer is a legit guy. And I think that golf is, tricky, because I think, I think that the audience is getting smaller and smaller. And so, you know, it's got to be a perfect storm. So I hope I answered your question.
Oh, you did. But, you did, sir.
You know, and meanwhile, Donald Trump says he's a two, by the way. he's a two like I'm a two, you know. So that's all.
Okay, what is your handicap?
I'm a guy who plays twice a year and looks like a guy who plays twice a year. And I'd like to play more. But, you know, in New York, it's a 9-hour day if you want to play golf. It's just there's too far to go. You know, I grew up with my parents. You know, you'd throw your shoes in the back of the car, and you'd be on the first tee in 20 minutes, and you'd get around in 3.5 hours. That was golf to me, and it's not like that anymore. I'll tell you a great story about my younger brother. My uncle was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2009 down in St. Augustine. And my brother and I went down. My brother's 2 years younger. He's got a beautiful swing. And I was we were both a year and a half out of hip replacement surgery. And so I hadn't played in a year and a half, and my brother hadn't played either. And with rented clubs, my brother on the back nine of a good layout of the Squire, the Gene Sarazen layout, my brother shot a 38 with an 8.
Wow.
That's what we're dealing with. Yeah. With rented clubs, hadn't played in a year and a half. So I'm going to take some credit for that, because I was there.
the last sports related thing, and then we'll get to the Letterman stuff.
Okay.
Please tell me how you figured out that Tonalist was going to win that race, because I've got recording debts like you wouldn't believe.
And please tell me that you bet it too. Okay.
Well, here's the deal. Before I tell you how it happened, you know, so I picked the winner in the Belmont at 20-1. You know, even if I was still gambling and I'm 19 years almost from my last bet, even if I put 20 grand to win on Tonalist, maybe I'd be even for my life.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But what are we talking about here? But here's what happened. You know, there have been, has it been 8 or 9 in the last few years, horses that had a shot at it might actually be 11, but there have been about 4 or 5 in the last 10 years. You know, Smarty Jones and Funny Side and I'm going to forget, but there were about 4 or 5 in the last few years, and I never took them, Big Brown, I never took them seriously going into the Belmont. But this one felt different. It felt different. It looked different. And I said, you know what? I think we're going to have, this just feels different. This feels like it's going to happen. And I really thought that the California Chrome was going to win. And then it's the day of the race, and it's about a half hour before the race, and I'm looking at the track, and I'm looking at the crowd, and all of a sudden, and I've been to the Belmont, all of a sudden, this looks a little too imposing, and all of a sudden, that stretch looks a little too wide, and I start to think, you know, this doesn't, and I saw him in the paddock, and I thought, you know, this, I got to go look for another horse now. And I'm a guy, I would never bet favorites. I would always take a stand against the favorite. So I said, I think I need to look for another horse here. So now, I start to look around, and basically it was 3 things about Tonalist. A, he'd won the Peter Pan, so he knew the track. B, the jockey shift, that the jockey went off right on Curlin, who had been in the Derby and the Preakness, to ride this horse in the Belmont. That's always huge, a jockey shift. So the third thing for me was, so now it's about 20 minutes before post, and it's the post parade. Look in the post parade at 15 minutes, and they post the odds, and I see that his odds had clicked down from, 12-1 to 11-1, which meant he got late money. And that, to me, that was it. Once I saw that the board clicked down, I said, you know what? There's some money behind this horse. And that was one of the things I always looked for. So with 15 minutes before, I posted on Twitter, 15 minutes, and it's timestamped, 15 minutes before post, I said, look, you know, take it from a degenerate gambler who hasn't made a bet since October 16th, 1995, throw your wallet at the 11 Tonalist. And the thing, a perfect race, ran a beautiful race, and I'm telling you, I was so pleased with myself. and I also had a nice little segment for the end of my Letterman segment, so that was, but it was great. I loved it. I really loved it. It was, but like I said, you know, if I was still playing and I put 20 grand on it, maybe I'd get even for my life.
All right, and we're going to, I'll speed it up before those biscuits get a hold of you and you get sleepy.
We're way past that. I'm telling you, my plumbing is fine. I'm all set. that eagle has landed.
Okay. wow, all right. Since David Letterman announced his retirement, I just wanted to ask, has the mood at the backstage at the show, has it been bittersweet, or is everybody kind of feeling like they're on a victory lap with him now? What's the mood currently?
Okay, I'll tell you that I knew about it about 2 hours before the rest of the world knew about it. He brought the senior staffers down into his office and told us. And I remember as he was telling us, I could feel myself smiling, because you don't know how you're going to react to the news. I was stunned, but I could feel myself smiling. And I was smiling because I knew that he would get to leave on his own terms and be the first guy that ever did that. Because not even Carson got to leave on his own terms. Carson left a year earlier than he wanted to leave. Carson wanted to do over 30 years and, you know, all the nonsense with Jay Leno and his manager at the time. So not even Carson got to leave on his own terms. So that was, I was happy about that. And I was also happy that all of us who had been there 20 plus years, that we were all going to make it. So I was, you know, I was happy. And then what happened is, you know, people started asking me, oh my God, what are you going to do? You know, they come up to me, what are you going to do? And, you know, I would say to them, listen, we got 200 shows left. I'm not even thinking about this. And then they would, you know, people kept asking me. And I started to get really annoyed. It's like, oh, stop it. You know, stop it. I got another year left. I don't even want to think about being a 58-year-old Jew gag writer on the street. and it really, I couldn't have a normal conversation with anybody. And then somebody, and thank God this person did this, somebody said to me, listen to me, this isn't just happening to Dave. And this isn't just happening to you and the people that work at the show. This is happening to everybody. People have known this guy for 33 years. He's been in their homes for 33 years. So when people are saying to you, oh my God, what are you going to do? They're not saying that. They're saying, what am I going to do? So ever since that was raised to me, I answer every question. And, you know, I feel like that we're all kind of in this together, and we're all going to go through this. So I don't know if that's that answers your question, but that's the overwhelming thing I feel these days.
You mentioned Johnny Carson. After he left the Tonight Show, I know sporadically, or it may have been more of a routine thing, he would write jokes and fax them to the Letterman show.
Some of them, and you know, if you fax in a joke and it gets on the air, you get $75, and Dave would FedEx him $75. He would FedEx them back ripped up. And it went on and on for years.
Do you, the actual physical faxes, do they exist in a vault somewhere? Do you know the ones that Carson sent in?
That's a wonderful question. I don't think they do. I don't think they do.
Okay.
That's a great question, but no, nobody thought to save those.
This is a nerd question. You don't have to spend.
But nobody thought to save those because none of us knew how sick he was. And then what happened was, as I was with Dave, we went to his indie team. They had won. It was in 2004. His team, their driver Buddy Rice, won the Indy 500. So in January of 2005, Dave and I flew to Dearborn, Michigan, where they presented the Borg Warner Trophy to Buddy Rice and Dave and Bobby Rahal. So we, while we're in the air, all of a sudden, this news is leaked out that Johnny has been faxing in jokes to the show. And the reason why that news was leaked out was because he was dying. So it was sort of, you know, it was okay to do it back then. It was okay. It was just to sort of let people know that the end was near, and this is what he had been doing the last couple of days, the couple of years. So we were, but it was just leaked as a story. We all knew it was because he was dying, but it was just leaked as a story that he was faxing in jokes. So we get to Dearborn, and all of a sudden there's reporters there, and they ask Dave, is it true Johnny has been faxing in jokes to the show? And Dave says, absolutely. And then one reporter says, do you ever turn down any of the jokes? And Dave says, no, we break his heart.
All right. I'm sorry.
And then he dies the next day. Mm. So that's what I remember about that.
Do you ever think you would do stand-up again? Because the one Truant show I've seen in person, you would sprinkle a few jokes between songs, and I could tell you were digging people laughing at your, you know, that instant reaction to your jokes and you actually having the chance to say them. Do you think you would ever do stand-up again, or you...
Right, but of course, here's the deal. When I do that during a Truant show, I got the big kit in front of me and four other guys. So I'm not alone up there. So they laugh, they don't laugh, it doesn't mean anything. So it's so, you know, it's easy, you know, to, it's easy to be brave. But no, I'll never, no, because I don't have, like Adrian says, you don't have the sickness. I don't have the thing where I got to be on stage. Now, with the Truants, you know, I'm on stage, so I feel the need, if there's a break, that, you know, I have to throw out something. So that's just all part about being on stage and my responsibility. But I can understand why you would draw that conclusion. But I'll tell you what I like doing. I like going out on book tours and having a podium in front of me and you know, having my notes and telling a bunch of stories or telling a few jokes. And that's definitely not stand-up. That's just a guy with a podium in front of him, you know, giving a talk. That I love. But in terms of stand-up, you know, I was never... I was okay at it. I was pretty good at it, but I never had the commitment that that other people had. I never had the sickness, and you know, it's taken me and Adrian a long time to figure out why people make it and why they don't. And you know what it boils down to? It boils down to the people who make it. Good or bad, whether you like them or not, whether you think they're funny or not funny, they worked the hardest and they had the most commitment to their material. It's the commitment to the material. That's what makes a guy or a woman break through, where they really believe what they're delivering. And also they do the work, and there's a lot of work. And when I was a stand-up, I was not a hard worker at all. I had an act that was 45 minutes to an hour, and I made money off of it, and I kept doing it. But I wasn't like, you know, the guys that we know, that we've heard of, you know. So that's my long way of saying not on your life.
Okay. I've got two more questions, then we're going to throw it back to Hanks and give you a chance to win a valuable prize at the end of this. All right. My personal favorite recurring guest on the Letterman show is Don Rickles. I'll spend an hour or two on a Sunday afternoon just looking up clips of him on Letterman on YouTube. He seems to have a regard for you because half the time when he's not insulting Dave or the audience or the band, he's looking over in your direction, smiling. Do you have a Don Rickles story on the tip of your tongue you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah, well, the reason why is because over the years, when Dave has gone out to dinner with him, I go along with Dave. And so he's gotten to know me. And Adrian's been a couple times, and he likes Adrian as well, knowing that he likes comics. He likes being with comics. So I'll tell you, the last time we went out to dinner. So here's the group. It's me, Dave, Adrian, Regis, Joy Philbin, Don Rickles, his wife, and the two goons he always travels with. And so we get there. So here's the night. we get there a little early, and Don hasn't shown up yet, and Regis and Joy are there, and they've just gotten back from China, and Dave is talking to them about China, and he says, did you go to see the Great Wall? And they said, oh, yeah, of course. And Dave says, when was that built? And Joy Philbin says, I think during the 20s. And Adrian and I just turn away. It was built in the 6th century B.C. She thinks it was part of the new Hollywood.
No, was she being sincere, or was she just trying to bust your balls?
No. She was dead. So now, no. That was, I remember that. So that's the opening of the evening. Now Don comes, and what happens with Don when you go out to dinner with Don is that there are two toasts. There's a toast at the beginning of the evening, and, you know, where Don clinks his glass, and that is the signal that all talking amongst yourself has to stop. You know, it's now Don's time. And then there's a toast at the end of the meal, which means, you know, I've finished, you know, entertaining. Everybody go home. But he's so great, and he tells the great stories, and he tells the same story, and you never tire of him. But the thing that I remember from that night is, and he's telling stories, and he talks about busting. He loves to bust Regis's balls, which I can't get enough of. Dave and I cannot get enough. So we've been out like 3 hours, and he's telling the great stories, and I'm prompting him a little, and Dave is prompting him a little, and Adrian is mentioning names, and he's telling, so, you know. So now it's but it's kind of all on Don's terms as it is. So now it's near the end of the evening, and he's talking about working at one of the Indian casinos. And he clearly has a story loaded up that he is now about to tell. And he starts to tell the story, and Regis interrupts him and says, Don, when you go to the Indian casino, do you just go wild? And Rickles turns and says, no, I read a poem. That was my favorite moment in that. I love that. And when I wrote for his special, the One Night Only special, and I also looked at all his old Letterman appearances and old Carson appearances. And with me, with Don, it's the stuff, talk about commitment to the material. Because the material in and of itself, you know, not that inspired, but his commitment makes it inspired. And my favorite thing, I think it was either his last time on or his second to last time on, it's always the very first thing he says. He comes out, you know, it takes him a long time to get out. He sits down, the band starts playing, and he looks at Dave and says, great to be on a show that's not catching on. I mean, the first thing out of his mouth. I just love that. It's great to be on a show that's not catching on. I just love that.
My favorite from the last appearance I saw, he was making fun of his wife, and he said, it's great to be married to a Valium.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, there's a million. To me, it's always, you know, being a comic, it's never the bits. It's always the incidental stuff. And I'll find one for you now. Ask me another question. I'll find one for you. Okay, I'm going to look it up, and I know you'll like it when I find it.
I'm going to ask you one more entertainment question, then I'm going to let Hanks wrap it up here. I always thought Richard Jenny was kind of an underrated comic, and of course he died too soon in a very sad way. I just wanted to know, were you friends with him? Did you have a good Richard Jenny story?
I was very good friends with him, and I'm going to hang on 1 second, because I came up with, here's the thing with, he talks about, one time he was on the show with Don Rickles, and he crossed himself, and he said, you know, when Jews do that, it means the highway's closed.
I remember that one.
And, oh, my God.
And how about this line? He's talking about Jerry Lewis at the telethon. He says, you know, when Jerry hits the high notes all the kids get up and walk home. So I wanted to tell both those. Richard Jenny, I met him in 1982. We were working a club called the Rainy Night House in Queens. And he was very good then. And he just got better and better and better. And then in 1985, me and him and a guy named Kelly Rogers, who was very funny, was a guitar act. We went to Australia together. We were the first American comics to tour Australia. And we were a huge hit. It's the only time in my life where I've really actually been a celebrity, and it was in Australia. And, he was so prolific. And he was a guy, again, commitment to the material and worked really hard. But he was a guy that was so great on stage and really couldn't really manage life off stage. You know, on stage, he was in complete control. And off stage, he was just kind of a mess. But I was always really, really fond of him. And then he moved out to L.A. and I wasn't a comic anymore. I was working on the show, and we lost touch. And I would hear stories about him. And we had dinner in New York, me, him, and Adrian. Adrian was very fond of him as well. And I said to him, and I told this story at his memorial service. I said, and he and I, the last time I saw him, we wrote for Chris Rock on the Oscars, the 2009 Oscars. And I spent the most time I had spent with him in 23 years. And, he was, in many ways, he was still the same, but in many ways, he was irrevocably different. I didn't know the extent of what was wrong with him. But I tell this story. I told this story about him. And we were at a dinner, and I said, Rich, I've been telling a story about you for years, and I don't even know if it's true. And I tell the story, and I'll just tell you the story. So he gets a job on the Clint Eastwood movie Bird about Charlie Parker. And I mean, he doesn't just get a gig. He gets the ideal gig for a comic, which he gets one scene in the movie, and it's all him. It's the perfect gig for a comic who's not really an actor. So Clint Eastwood, it books him, he gets the gig. So now Clint Eastwood, if you know anything about Clint Eastwood, he is no nonsense. All his movies come in under budget. He never works longer than an 8-hour day because everybody does their homework and nobody wastes any time. That's everybody says this about him. He's unlike any other director. So here we go. So Rich Jenny comes in on his day. And the way they do it is Clint, he films all rehearsals and then tries to get it in as few takes as possible. So they rehearse Jenny's scene, and then Clint says to him at the end of the scene, he says, that was good, Richard, but could you do it again, and could you do it a little less angry? And Rich Jenny, in front of Clint Eastwood, the cast and the crew, says, I'm too angry. Walks into town and kills everybody.
Now, did Clint see the humor in that?
Clint Eastwood walks by the assistant director and says, get rid of him. And that was it. He was fired.
Oh, man.
That was it. And I told, and so I do that story, and I tell, and Jenny says, not only is that how it happened, but you tell the story better than I do. And I told that at his memorial. But that was, so like I said, he was a guy that if he wasn't on stage doing stand-up, he really couldn't quite, navigate life. And which is what made him such a great comic and what made the way his life ended so tragic.
All right. Well, thank you for talking to us for so long. I had delusions of us keeping this at 45 minutes, and you can see how that that went.
Nice going.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we talk slower down here, so if you, you use that dog ear thing. We have a chance for you to win a limited edition Kinston Free Press newspaper ink pen right now.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
Hanks happened. Has been cleaning his ears with it while we're talking. So it's,
you weren't supposed to tell him that. Okay.
We'll get him a fresh one.
Is it a real ink pen or is it a ballpoint pen
it's a ballpoint pen.
It's you know those free cheapos that you that people give away. It's below that.
But it says the free
press. I started to get excited.
But it says the free press on it, sir. And when you use that on the show, people are going to go, where in the hell did you get that pen? I must have one.
Right. Is there no oxygen where you guys are now? Because that last statement made no sense.
Well, we have to turn all the lights off because the fluorescent lights screw with this recorder. So we're sitting in the dark with the air off. So there's no buzz in the recording. So
that radon meter in there took sweet.
All right, this will be your torture will be over in a few minutes. I'm going to turn it over to Brian here.
See, and if we were any more, we had production here, we would have some music behind it. We would have, although if he does get it right, he's going to hear the sound
of
you go ding.
It'll be done in post.
Oh, okay, there you go.
We'll do it in post. Man's got biscuits to digest.
His last words.
Yeah.
Let me tell you one of the and let me set this up for the listeners. One of my favorite things that you've done on the Letterman show is where, and you've done it as you've been promoting your book too in a couple of different places, is you are just, I don't know, I guess a savant. You're just a genius when it comes to remembering uniform numbers, and me being the sports geek that I am too, decided to pick your brain a little bit on this too and see how good you are with it. The parameters I was given was any sports from 1957 to 1997. Major sports, and I'm going to start out a little bit easy, but it gets a little bit harder. I got about eight here, and then I have you a bonus question where you can even win an extra ink pen, okay?
All right, well, let's see. Boy, I hope this is a lot of pressure. Go ahead.
Here you go. Okay, let's start off. The 1957 Yankees, Billy Martin.
One.
Dang. The 1997 Carolina Panthers, Kerry Collins.
Oh, Kerry Collins was 12 with the Panthers, wasn't he?
Ding, ding, ding. And, of course, with him leading the Giants to the Super Bowl, what was his number there?
5.
Ah, dang.
Good grief.
This is insane. 1964-65 Boston Celtics, Tom Heinsohn.
Tom Heinsohn was 15.
Dang. The 1982 San Francisco Giants, Jack Clark.
Oh, Jack Clark with the, what year, I'm sorry, with
1982.
I think he was 25.
Oh, so close, 22, 22.
No, that was Will Clark was 22.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
How about that?
We'll in post, we'll go back and check that, but I would take your word for it, sir. Okay,
yes.
Now, being a Washington Redskins fan,
I'm confused about because I think Jack Clark was with the Cardinals then, and he wore 25 of them. But Will Clark, the first baseman, was 22.
That's fantastic. The 1982 Super Bowl winning Redskins in the strike year had a running back named Joe Washington.
Yeah, Joe Washington was number. He wore 27 with the Colts. And I think that he still, I think he wore, did he wear 27 with the Redskins? I'm going to say 27.
It was 25, sir.
Oh, he was 25. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's good. Okay. You got me on that
there
one.
You go. Let's go back to New York. From 78 to 80, they had a backup quarterback named Pat Ryan.
Patty Ryan wore number 10.
No, number 4, sir.
No. Pat Ryan wore 10.
Okay.
I'll tell you who wore 4 for the Jets was Glenn Foley, who was their backup quarterback. I'm pretty sure about this one.
Okay.
That Pat Ryan wore 10.
The 1991 Bad Boys Detroit Pistons, John Sally.
John Sally was 22.
Ding, ding, ding. The Big Red Machine, 1976, infielder Dave Concepcion.
13.
There you go. And the final one that I have for you, pitcher for the Montreal Expos, Steve Rogers.
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, that's a good one. Oh, boy. I'm seeing it. It's in the 20s. Boy, that's a great question. Hang on one second.
Okay.
Hang on a second. I think it's definitely in the 20s, and I think that he was 28.
Yeah, 45, sir. And he wore it for the whole time he was with the Expos. Only reason I have, like, five of his cards, so I'm a huge Steve Rogers
number?
Fan. 45, sir.
Steve Rogers wore 45?
Yes, sir, pitcher for the Expos.
Oh, not even close.
That's all right. And here's your bonus question. Rick Wild Thing Vaughn on Major League, played by Charlie Sheen, what did he wear?
99.
Ding, ding, ding. Listen, I was told not to ask you this question, but I have to, but it doesn't matter. Dawson's going to smack me upside the head when we get through. But how good is Third of Never featuring our own John Dawson?
Well, you know, let me tell you something. You know, John is really gifted. You know, there are guitarists, and then there are guys playing guitar, right? And there's a lot of guys playing guitar, and there's very few guitarists. And he, you know, he is really, and he's so modest. I mean, if there was a way, I believe, if there was a way to somehow just have the amp on stage and have him, you know, buy a radio attachment in the parking lot playing, you know, he would probably do it that way. He's, you know, because he's very, very humble. We got to watch them, and, you know, we did whatever we do, and they went on. It's a very impressive band, and it's a band that more people should know, and the other thing is they do a great variety of songs, and he's a, you know, look at this, Steve Rogers 45. I couldn't have been more killing me. Well, that's, you know, I won't forget that now, but I was really very taken with them. You know, they got guys that can sing. Their drummer is, you know, one of those guys that, you know, it's, you know, you want to get out of the business after you see that guy. And they do many, many things well. I mean, it was great to go on and then to sit back and watch them.
I sat in his office yesterday, and I knew he was going to bring that up, and I threatened him with death of bringing it up, and he brought it up anyway.
Yeah, Bill, but what you should never have worried, because you guys are the goods. You're absolutely the goods, and they, like I said, they you know, they don't do one thing, and they don't do two things. They do many things, and it was really a treat. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, well, you know, I mean, I tried to get them on the show, which shows you how much pull I have. Apparently, 23 years is not enough. I wish more people knew about them.
Well, Bill, I've got to say this. We've been doing this show for 5 years. We've won several North Carolina Press Association awards for it. We've had actors. We've had professional. Well, let me tell you, we've had professional athletes, actors, pretty much the whole spectrum of people through the years on this show. And unapologetically, and I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings out here, this is the most fun I've ever had with an interview. Thank you so much for being a part of our show this week, sir.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm very flattered. I mean, I think the world of John, and it was really my pleasure. And you know, I think about, and we didn't get to talk about him because I think we talked about him the last time. I always think about what John said about Bill Hicks, who was a friend of mine, a friend of my wife, that he couldn't believe that kind of brilliance came out of the mouth from somebody that sounded just like him. And I thought that was one of the great descriptions about what made Bill Hicks so accessible, was, you know, here was this brilliance coming out of, you know, and just sounding like to so many people down south and what it represented. You know, and I think about that all the time. But it was my pleasure. You know, I wasn't thrilled when I told you would be on the podcast, but you went very well. Other than the Steve Rogers question.
Very good.
Well, you still did well enough to win the pen, so...
Dynamite.
Yeah, it'll the postage to get it there will cost more than the pen itself, but it will be there.
Bill, thank you so much for being a part of the show, sir.
Take care.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Got to tell you, Dawson, that was a blast. And here's the sad thing, and I know you don't like me crinkling near the microphone here, but I literally had six or seven more questions I wanted to ask.
I cut five of mine just because, you know, you could ask Bill Sheff, hey, what time is it? And he'd give you an answer.
That would be entertaining, yes.
Because I, you know, I don't historically get involved in sports all that much because when I played Little League, it was hard. But, you know, when he was sitting there talking about sports stuff that I'd foreign to me, it was still interesting.
Yeah.
So,
well, what a blast. I mean, this is going to be, I think we'll be entering this one, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. But, Bill Sheff, thank you so much. If you want to find out more about him, go to his website at www.billsheft.com. That's SCHEFT.com. I know when we post this, we're going to have links to his website.
His new book is called Shrink Thyself.
Absolutely. Pick up a copy of his book. Listen, I'm going to buy a copy of it.
Well, mine, you know? I ordered mine a week ago, so I'm hoping I can probably weed it. Weed it? It doesn't need weeding. It needs reading in a weekend.
Well, it's awesome. I got a sweet-ass Amazon.com card from my significant other. So guess what I'm going to use my Amazon.com card for?
Well, you should definitely get The Ringer.
Okay.
I mean, I guess you could borrow my copy, but
no,
Thurgood Brothers
no,
some commerce and buy it.
Yeah, I'd like to help the man.
That would be – if you get The Ringer, because I know you read that, then you're going to I can't even speak. I got so embarrassed by that stuff at the end. You're going to want to read everything he's written after you read The Ringer. Time Won't Let Me is what hooked me in because it was tied to music. This is a sports thing, so that'll pull you in.
I can't wait, and I'm going to. I want to thank the most fun we've had with a guest, Bill Sheff. I mean, listen, we talked to the mayor of Kinston one day. We talked to Bill Sheff the next day.
Mm-hmm.
We live a charmed life, John Dawson.
Got him by the short ones, haven't we?
Yes, we do. John Dawson, if people want to find out more about that music that Bill Sheff himself was bragging about or your books
anyway,
how do they do that?
They go to johndawson.com, johndawson.com.
Fantastic. Listen, we will wrap this up with saying we want to throw some love out to someone who is leaving the Free Press, Jessica Meadows, who's been, I don't even think it's being sarcastic or anything, I'm being dead serious, a ray of sunshine in her office. Am I correct or am I correct?
A shaft of light in the mind.
There you go. Jessica Meadows, who's been here for a number of years, 3 or 4 years at least, she's leaving us for greener pastures up in the Wayne County area, so we want to thank her for everything she's done here. And again, I don't know how you replace somebody like that every single time you see her. She is just a fountain of positivity. I mean, when have you ever seen her not smile?
Usually when she sees me, but other than that, I want to throw in something else about Bill Sheff.
Yeah.
He's obviously got life by the short ones, as we say, too, but he did a lot of work for us that he doesn't need.
Now, when you say for us, you mean for Third of Never.
Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't need anything. He gains nothing by helping us. He put a lot of effort
And
to try and
well, he mentioned that. He alluded to that.
Yeah, and he worked on that off and on for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I was Bill Sheff writing for Letterman and you got some guy that sounds like Jethro from, can you help get my band on TV? You know, but, you know, he didn't need to do that. So he's one of those guys when sometimes you see somebody famous and you really think they shouldn't be famous, they shouldn't be successful. I hope when I see that he's successful, I'm like, that guy earned it, and I'm very happy. And on top of it, he's a nice guy.
Well, and this is the first time I had talked to him. I know you've had a lot of interaction with him, and you've bragged about him through the years. And you actually had him on a Free Press radio show I wasn't able to be a part of.
Mm.
Was it a year ago, 2 years ago?
I'm going to say two.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And he was awesome on that, and I hated that I missed that one. That's the reason I insisted on wanting to be a part of this one. And, I think it's the best show we've had. I mean, you know, like I told him, you know, we've had professional athletes on here. We've had champions. We've had actors. We've had, you know, TV personalities from all over. And I don't know. I guarantee you I haven't laughed more than I have in the last hour and a half. So, Bill Sheff, thank you so much. Again, www.billsheff.com. We thank you, dear listener, for listening to the podcast this week or to the Free Press Radio show. And do you have anything else before I give my little tagline?
I don't know. Do you think we've got the show's long enough? Do you think we've got enough material?
It's probably the longest one we've done, I'm sure, once you get through. Wait a minute. Are you going to be adding like the sound effects to the game show there?
I don't know. I feel kind of bad that we stumped him on a couple.
Well, you know what? And I'm going to defend him here. I mean, I did. Did you notice when I was putting these together?
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes before we started the show, so there's a good chance. Like I said, of all those, I'm sure about Steve Rogers because I grew up as a Steve Rogers fan, being an Expos fan.
Mm-hmm.
But and I'm pretty sure about Joe Washington too. He said he was 27 and he was 25 on the Super Bowl champion year. But I would bet you Joe Washington, because he played in a couple other places before he got to the Redskins.
Mm-hmm.
He probably wore 27 somewhere else. So listen, you think I'm going to doubt that man? Come on now.
Well, he's such a nice guy. If I could have said it without it being on mic, I would have just said, just go along with it.
Just go, yeah.
He deserves, some good stuff to go back his way.
Well, the fact that he got Charlie Sheen's number, Rick Wild Thing Vaughn.
If I started to be a real jackass and say, all right, what was my number in Little League? And he would have probably known it.
That would have been pretty cool. Well, listen, thank you so much for listening to the show. We'll see you next week on your iPod.